support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Stephen Sondheim's rapturous musical, A Little Night Music. Featuring an all-star cast, A Little Night Music begins performances at ACT's Geary Theater May 20th. ACT-SF.org.
Support for the California Report comes from the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And Barracuda Networks, innovators of network security and data protection solutions designed to thwart cyber threats and data loss for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at barracuda.com/KQED.
It is Memorial Day weekend, and today we remember military service often overlooked, Latino veterans of the Vietnam War.
It's our way of understanding the kinds of opportunities or even lack of opportunities that existed. It also tells us a lot about the way that Vietnam War was reaching into a lot of poor barrios all throughout California and in a disproportionate way.
Plus the Filipino-American DJs who created a cultural soundtrack.
The scene back in the day was legendary, and I mean, people still talk about it.
If you were a Filipino teenager growing up in the Bay Area in that era, you had probably some connection to the scene.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. Monday is Memorial Day, and this year it marks the 50th anniversary of the U.S. military's first major strike against North Vietnam. It was 1965, and by the time the war ended, almost 60,000 American troops were dead, many more wounded. A lot of the troops in that war were Latino, but to this day, no one knows exactly how many. But as the California Report's L.A. Bureau Chief Stephen Cuevas tells us, a historian in Southern California is working to change that.
When Freddy Romero went off to war, his sense of geography wasn't the best.
I didn't know what Vietnam was. I just thought I'm going to China.
Romero was like a lot of kids from East L.A. who came of age during the Vietnam War. His family didn't have much money. He flunked out of school. So at the tender age of 17, he signed up with the Marines.
I was just a little boy, very sheltered, even though I grew up in East L.A., going into a situation that I knew nothing about. But when I got there, I just fell right in.
Romero shared his story with students from Pomona College for an oral history project led by Tomas Summers Sandoval, a history professor and the son of a Vietnam War veteran.
I mean, one of the earliest memories I have is of this green photo album of all my dad's pictures from Vietnam. And I remember being a small kid, you know, before you even understand what war is, looking at pictures of my 19-year-old father in Vietnam.
Summers Sandoval began asking questions about the experience of his dad and other relatives who also served. Their sacrifices have never been fully measured.
The U.S. military didn't keep separate data on Latinos. Latinos were not considered their own racial ethnic category. They were just folded into the white population.
At the height of the war, around 10% of U.S. residents were Latino, but a study from Cal State LA found Latinos were 20% of all U.S. troops killed in Vietnam. But that research only covered the first few years of the conflict. Summers Sandoval is going further, scrutinizing census data and casualty reports to finally learn the true number of Latinos lost. Just as important, capturing the real-life stories of veterans like Freddy Romero, and in the process, painting a picture of Latino enclaves like East Los Angeles before and after the war.
It's our way of understanding the kinds of opportunities or even lack of opportunities that existed. It also tells us a lot about the way that the Vietnam War was reaching into a lot of poor barrios all throughout California and in a disproportionate way.
A lot of Latinos didn't qualify for deferments because they were high school dropouts or were not enrolled in college. In an interview recorded by student researchers, veteran David Lopez remembers what a high school counselor told him when he turned 17.
He called me into his office and he said to me, "You're so darn dumb that you'll never make it in college." And that pretty much set the tone for what I was going to do next.
Lopez says he decided to enlist in the U.S. Marine Corps.
You know, one thing about the Latino culture, the Latinos in general, we're warriors from the get-go. We've been fighting for our rights, for this country forever. I felt that the Marine Corps was the best way to go because the Marine Corps trains warriors to be better warriors.
Don't push me down if I found you what I say.
While thousands of young Latinos were swept into the military, others were fighting against the war. This year also marks the 45th anniversary of the Chicano Moratorium, when thousands of Latinos flooded into the streets of East L.A. in August of 1970.
It was the largest protest march by Mexican Americans that anyone could remember, and the protest was against the war.
Some veterans, like Victor Chavez, began questioning their role in Vietnam once they got home.
You know, I sat there for a year really wondering, what the hell did I do? What did we do?
But Chavez says the military gave him direction. He got married and raised a family. He enrolled in college and eventually became a high school principal.
I think that's a misperception about Vietnam veterans, that somehow this war wrecked all our lives. I have very strong feelings about Vietnam, but it didn't wreck my life. I think it motivated my life, you know.
Professor Summer Sandoval says Latino veterans actually did better economically than Latinos who didn't serve.
A higher income, more likely to have a college education, more likely to be a homeowner, all these kinds of things that we used to measure economic success.
Heroism on the battlefield is widely celebrated in films and on holidays, but Summer Sandoval says his research also looks at the kind of quiet heroism that went on after these veterans returned home from Vietnam.
To me, they're all heroes just for the ability to live their lives after the war in a society that was very often not willing to even recognize them, to not even acknowledge their experience.
Tomas Summer Sandoval's book, chronicling the experiences of Latinos in the Vietnam War, is due out next year. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Los Angeles.
Since the Vietnam War, we've learned a whole lot about psychological injuries, like PTSD. Of course, it's not unique to veterans. In fact, we now know it can even affect school kids who grow up in places with lots of gun violence, including Oakland. As part of our series, Books and Bullets, we're looking at how teachers and counselors there work to heal the hidden wounds of these kids, wounds that can make learning that much harder. Here's KQED's education reporter, Zadie Stavely.
Oakland's first homicide victim last year was a boy named Lee Weathersby III. He was shot and killed while walking home from the Boys and Girls Club New Year's Eve. Police said it was a case of mistaken identity. Lee would have turned 14 that year. His death hit his middle school hard. On his birthday, 400 students from Alliance Academy gathered in a circle on the school blacktop with his family and sang to remember him.
Happy birthday.
The middle schoolers marched around the school and lined up on 98th Avenue. They held up their index fingers and thumbs to make an L for Lee and love. They shouted, "L's up." Then they pointed their fingers down, shouting, "Guns down." Diamond Allen is a student who helped organize the event. He and Lee had been friends since the first day of sixth grade.
It used to be Lee, myself, Damon, Romello, and Keyshawn, just always hanging out with each other after school, going to each other's houses, going to play basketball. Just, we were like brothers.
When there's a crisis like this one, when a student is killed or wounded, or a shooting happens near a campus, or children sidestep dead bodies on the way to school, a special team arrives to give grief counseling. The week after Lee's death, almost 200 kids had to get therapy. Diamond was one of them.
It was hard just in class, focusing in class, just knowing that Lee was not sitting by me. Lee was not there. It was an empty seat.
The head of behavioral health at Oakland Unified is Barbara McClung. She says the effects of violence on kids like Diamond spill into the classroom and cause
difficulty concentrating, hypervigilance.
I was hurt inside. I was angry. I was sad.
Feeling hopeless or helpless.
So many mixed emotions going on.
Being fearful or afraid.
Just like confused, like why it happened.
All those things require a lot of skill at self-regulation in order to sort of suppress that and focus on academic content. And for many of our students, that's just really impossible.
Yeah, I got my first C.
Think about this. During the time it's taken for a kid in Oakland to go from kindergarten to senior year in high school last year, 111 children under 18 have been killed by gun violence in the city. More than 1,280 have been reported wounded. That doesn't even include adults in these children's lives who were killed or wounded. Barbara McClung says it adds up.
When we convene kids at school sites and we sit in circle together and we ask, besides this event, have you ever lost anyone due to violence? 3/4 of the students, no matter what grade they're in, you know, elementary school kids, middle, high school, raise their hand and then they share out how they've lost their father, they've lost their uncle, they've lost their brother, they've lost their cousin, they've lost their sister.
Because violence is concentrated in certain neighborhoods of Oakland, certain schools have more kids traumatized by violence. Marisa Morales teaches 3rd grade at Community United Elementary School in a neighborhood that sees some of the most gunshots in the city. She says you can see the effects in her 8-year-olds.
Sometimes the tears just want to come out and they feel like they don't even know why. So that'll lead to one of my students just completely unprovoked punching a girl in the face. Students trying to read but not being able to focus on the words. So they just sit there and they stare at a book and they're trying so hard, but they can't.
Oakland has tried to put more mental health therapists in schools that need them the most. And there is some progress here. In 2000, only a handful of schools in Oakland had a therapist. Beginning last year, the district says all schools have at least one. That's mostly because of a partnership with Alameda County's Health Services Agency under Alex Briscoe.
We took a lemon, which is the increasing concentration of poverty in public education. It's a harsh truth. And we turned it into lemonade.
What Briscoe did was take Medi-Cal money and redirect it to put mental health therapists on site in the public schools. Briscoe says in 6 years, the county doubled the number of children from low-income families it's helping with mental health.
They stay in school longer. They do better in school. They go to the emergency room less. Eh? You know, I mean, the stuff you, healthy development of children, right? Now, we know what healthy development is. We know how to support it. It happens in rich communities every day.
The problem is, there are wait lists for therapists. Long wait lists. After the first week of grief counseling, Diamond never started regular therapy. In their kitchen, his mom, Nicole, pulls up a video she made a couple years ago on the computer.
Oh, yeah, they're being kids.
It's Lee and Diamond and a bunch of their friends, girls and boys, playing leapfrog in a park.
They don't even look like this anymore. That's Lee with the red shirt right there.
Diamond puts his head down on the kitchen table. He can't watch. Later, in his bedroom, he reaches into the closet and pulls out a white T-shirt covered with scribbles, the kind middle schoolers give to their friends to write on at the end of the year.
He wrote, Lee Weathersby, Diamond, I will miss you, brother.
The pain is still there. Diamond's just learning to live with it. For the California Report, I'm Zadie Stavely in Oakland.
Zadie's report was produced in collaboration with Renaissance Journalism's Equity Reporting Project, Restoring the Promise of Education, with funding from the Ford Foundation. Los Angeles saxophonist Kamasi Washington's new CD is called The Epic. And that's a good name because it's 3 hours of music on 3 CDs, touching on a whole bunch of different styles. The California Report's jazz critic, Andrew Gilbert, says this sprawling work is a lot to take in, but it has its rewards. Here's his review.
It's hard to know where to start with The Epic, the crazily ambitious and widely hyped new album by Los Angeles saxophonist, producer, and arranger Kamasi Washington. Publications that don't usually pay much attention to jazz are hailing him as a jazz savior, creating music that's daring and fresh. Maybe. But The Epic isn't so much dangerous and new as strange, grandiose, and bewildering. It's part manifesto, part cinematic funhouse, and one hot mess. And did I mention that it's also a whole lot of fun? The opening track, Change of the Guard, ends up sounding like an outtake from the original Star Trek theme, introducing the soaring, wordless vocals that show up repeatedly throughout the album. in his early 30s, Washington sounds like he's trying to bridge different generations of African-American music. He's been embraced by Kenny Burrell and Gerald Wilson, the greatest elder statesmen of the Southland jazz scene. But he's also toured with Snoop Dogg and Rafael Sadiq. And the buzz surrounding the epic comes from his associations with the worlds of hip-hop and R&B. More recently, Washington collaborated with Kendrick Lamar on his critically hailed hit To Pimp a Butterfly. And some of the instrumental tracks on the epic feel like an addendum to that project. When Washington serves as his own lyricist, I'm not sure the songs stand up to repeated listening. Here's The Rhythm Changes, one of several pieces featuring vocalist Patrice Quinn, with chorus and strings.
Our minds, our bodies, our feelings, they change, they alter, they leave us somehow. No matter what happens, I'm here.
Almost half of the album's 17 tracks clock in at well over 10 minutes and end up wearing out their welcome. My favorite pieces tend to be the instrumentals, like the atmospheric ballad Isabel, which sounds like an early tune by the pioneering fusion band Weather Report. So, is Washington looking backwards or forwards, or is he just messing with us, like on a loopy arrangement of Cherokee? It's a tune famously treated as a furious sprint by beboppers, but in Washington's hands, it becomes an easy grooving stroll, a la Hugh Masekela's Grazing in the Grass. Washington closes the album with The Message, which left me pondering, what exactly is he trying to say? My takeaway is that Kamasi Washington is willing to try just about anything. It may not work, it may even be ridiculous, but it's not going to be boring. For a project as sweeping and, well, epic as The Epic, that's an impressive achievement in itself.
Andrew Gilbert is a Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Kamasi Washington's The Epic. In Malaysia, life for a divorced woman can be tough. Even after coming to the United States, the challenges linger. And that brings us to our series, Between Homelands, where we teamed up with students from USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Jocelyn Coffin brings us the story of a Los Angeles woman who's learning to be a virtual mom to her two sons growing up almost 9,000 miles away.
This morning, I was up at 4 in the morning, tossing and turning, insomnia. This is also one of the things that happens when your children are far away.
Saraya Ayudin is pursuing a master's degree in public diplomacy at the University of Southern California. But her mind is constantly pulled to her boys in Penang, Malaysia. Skype is what connects them.
Hi, man.
Hello.
What are you doing?
I'm sitting in my bed.
My eldest son, he's 11, so I know he's going through that preteen age, and it's so hard to just have a conversation with him.
Sometimes Iman would rather spend time reading Marvel comic books. But Ayudin tries to make it feel like they're hanging out together in the living room, practicing English and playing games.
Hearing their voices is the most perfect voice ever for me.
Okay, your turn. Make a funny face.
I have a duck face.
That's a duck face?
Not seeing them on a daily basis is hard enough. Not seeing them on a weekly basis was harder. Being here is the hardest. So, you know, there's no way to go around the fact that you don't have them in your life.
5 years ago, Ayudeen was shocked when her husband said he wanted to end their marriage. Almost unthinkable in a Muslim country.
Divorce is perceived as something that you would not do.
For Ayudeen, the fallout was complicated, but the act of divorce was simple.
From the Sharia court, as long as he would state it out loud that he divorces you, then you're divorced.
Her ex-husband and his new wife created a tight family circle that included her two sons, but limited her ability to see them.
My role as the mom is already going to get replaced by somebody else.
Ayudeen felt increasingly empty as she saw her children less and less. Finally, she made the decision to leave Malaysia to create something new for herself.
Was either going to school, married, or settling somewhere else.
When she came to secular Los Angeles, she found a community of Muslim women and a new relationship with her faith. In the newly opened Women's Mosque of America, Ayudeen joins other women in customary ablutions, washing her feet before she enters the sanctuary. Light streams through stained glass as women kneel and pray. In Malaysia, imams are men, and women are relegated to separate prayer spaces. In this mosque, a woman leads female worshippers in prayer in the main hall. For the first time, Ayudeen feels able to practice her religion free of societal pressures.
So I feel like this safe space in coming to terms with the faith and not just practicing it because it's culturally embedded in you, I feel I get that more right here than I did in Malaysia.
Ayudeen's discovering herself in a new way in Los Angeles, and she's even remarried. But she had never given up hope of being reunited with her sons, and that requires her to be patient with her ex-husband.
If I'm not on good terms with him, then I won't be able to talk to my children, and that's something that that's always looming inside my head. And he's been talking about some of the things where there might be a possibility for me to bring them here.
Today, Los Angeles feels like home for Ayudeen, but until she's with her sons again, she'll always be stretched between two worlds.
Ayman, I love you.
I love you too.
I miss you.
I miss you.
For the California Report, I'm Jocelyn Coffin in Los Angeles.
If you were a teenager in the 80s, this music might remind you of being in a nightclub.
Jumping music, slick DJs, fog machines and laser rays.
But for Filipino Americans, pop hits like this became a kind of cultural soundtrack. They were remixed by a generation of Filipino-American DJs and played at parties, weddings, birthdays, anniversaries, that kind of thing. And there's a new book out describing how that music scene, it was born in the San Francisco Bay Area, how it led to the emergence of some internationally famous DJs. Sam Harnett reports.
A bunch of young DJs have gathered around Orlando, Madrid. We're in his garage in Daly City, south of San Francisco. There are stacks of records and music equipment all around. Madrid is playing a classic.
Can't take my eyes off of you, my boy Sound Gang.
It's cha-cha, Madrid explains. Yes, cha-cha is a kind of ballroom dance, originally from Cuba. Remixed like this, it's a Filipino-American hit.
It's that rhythm that wants you to dance the cha-cha.
Madrid's been spinning records for decades. He was one of the first generation of Filipino-American DJs in the early 80s. He puts on another remix from his playlist. You may recognize the tune. It's Memory from the Broadway musical Cats.
The scene back in the day was legendary, and I mean, people still talk about it.
Kevin Brown is one of the young DJs crowded around Madrid. That scene back in the day was mostly high schoolers, throwing parties in suburban garages and having competitions, DJ battles. They formed groups, mobile DJ crews, four or five kids to do lighting, sound, and music.
If you were a Filipino teenager growing up in the Bay Area in that era, you had probably some connection to the scene.
Oliver Wang is a professor of sociology at California State University, Long Beach. He's written a book called Legions of Boom. It's all about those mobile DJ crews. Wang says some of the young DJs following in Madrid's footsteps eventually broke out and got famous. But instead of just playing records, they started scratching them.
Now you,
people like Hubert, people like Mixmaster Mike, Apollo, Shortcut.
This is Jonathan Cruz, a.k.a. DJ Shortcut.
Now you be a DJ.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I credit a lot of what I do now to the mobile scene.
Cruz says, like most, he got his start at family gigs. You know, where people demanded those 80s hits.
It's funny, man. It's early 80s aerobic music.
Now Cruz remixes a wide variety of music, and he's won regional and national DJ battles. He says Filipino-Americans like him used to stand out at competitions.
I heard people under people's breath, like, who are these Chinese guys out of nowhere, you know, from the West Coast coming out here to battle?
Since then, the Filipino-American population has grown. Now, it's the largest Asian-American minority in California. Half of the country's entire 3.4 million live here. Daly City has the highest concentration of any U.S. city. Orlando Madrid says you can see the evidence in the air.
The joke is there's a lot of fog here because everybody's cooking rice.
Madrid says the whole DJ scene here was about more than just playing pop music. It was a way to form an identity as the kids of immigrants. Now, Madrid never got famous, but he says the music kept him away from drugs and violence, fallout from local Filipino-American gangs.
Well, the way I've recognized it is DJing kept me out of a lot of trouble that I could have got into.
Many Filipino-American DJs have been encouraged by the community and their families. They bought them equipment and drove them to parties. It makes sense. They were also getting down to this music. For the California Report, I'm Sam Harnett in Daly City.
From the Bay Area, y'all, San Francisco, my man DJ Disc.
Shortcut.
And DJ
Hubert in the house.
Let's get ready to rumble, y'all.
And on that note, we are done with the California Report for this week. It is a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is DJ Susie Racho, known all over the world as...
I don't know. You want high school or college DJ name?
Lay them both on me.
High school, DJ Q. College, Psychedelic Susie.
The technical producer is Seal Mahler. Seal, what is your DJ name?
CC Rap-A-Lot.
Ooh, I like it. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman.
It's Howie Goodwrench.
Did you just make that up?
No, I used it in the film industry many years ago. Art film, Scott.
Our interns are Michelle Dutro. Michelle, what is your DJ name?
My DJ name is DJ Mish Mish.
Because?
Because in college, I DJed for KUGS in Bellingham.
Also, Piles of Airy, a.k.a. Paisy. Our online team includes David Weir. And David, if you were a DJ, or maybe you were a DJ, what was your DJ name?
David Weir.
Also, David Marks, Lisa Pickoff White, and Olivia Allen Price. The California Report's editorial team includes...
Victoria Mauleon.
And your DJ name?
Slick Vic.
Also, Tyke Hendricks, Julia McAvoy, Ingrid Becker, a.k.a. Ingie Pop, and
Holly Kernan, DJ Hollyanna, yeah, really happy music.
And I'm Scott Schaefer, a.k.a. Scooter Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. More at irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of children at risk in California.